Standing up in McKinney, this is According to Callus, episode 626, coming to you on the 25th of April, the year of our Lord, 2024. And today we're going to chat about book two in the Blue Dawn series. You know, I had intended on doing another episode after my interview yesterday, but, you know, life just kind of gets in the way. There's a lot I'd like to say or address right now. It's probably best that I don't. It's probably best that I let the things sit for another day or so, lest I say something that I regret or I can't take back. Suffice it to say, it's been a challenging few weeks in the old life of Stephen. But as they say, things never get old. So that being said, I will have a episode for Friday. I'm looking to do a five for Friday because there's at least five different things that I can hit on for about 3 to 5 minutes each and give you something to start the weekend off. So today, before I start the review, let me remind you the biggest thing that I need from you guys, my listeners, to do is to subscribe, like, and share the program. Following's great, too. Anything you can help me to do to overcome the algorithms. They are, they're not very friendly. It's been a challenge. I'm not going away. I'm not quitting. No matter how hard it is, I just don't have a lot of quit in me. So while we're at it, let me remind you, I have the social media stuff. I have a page and a group over at Facebook. I'm a pro at Gab. I drop in at MeWe. And for now, for still, there is my show available over at YouTube. Just audio. I chose to focus on a podcast so that I could stick to audio, because quite frankly, it's much easier and quicker to do this, not have to mess with all the editing and different things that would be required with a visual component as well. Perhaps at some point in the future, we'll look at doing that. But for right now, we're going to focus on the audio. We're going to focus on making sure that you get a quality show and that it's pithy. And I think 30 minutes is plenty pithy. If I can get it under 30 minutes and still cover all the content, so much the better. But I tend to not want to ever exceed 35 minutes. That should give you, at 1.5 speed, roughly 20 minutes worth of programming. And most people commute for far longer than that. And I imagine that most people have an attention span for listening to me talk of no more than 20 minutes. So, without further ado, book two in the Blue Dawn series is called A Most Uncivil War. Now, we're following some of the characters that were brought up in the first book. There's a couple of other characters that take center stage, if you will, in book two. Namely, we have the guy that had been in hiding, who is now your... Well, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but suffice it to say, the guy that was the vice president is back in the back on the scene, and he is now the acting president, if you will. And you're getting some more character development on some of the operatives, and you're seeing some of the inner workings of the progressive socialists that are running the country. Now, I want to take a moment out here. I want to highlight. So Blaine L. Pardoe has written the series. And as an author, I appreciate where he's coming from. And he's on book five, and I've started reading book three. And if somebody can write a good story and get you buy-in on the characters, or at least some of the characters, or concern, or however you want to phrase it, that's a good author. So if I was going to complain, one of the primary characters that I got buy-in on in book one is virtually absent in book two. Now, I don't want to say that's terrible because I know the person's not dead and gone. It just, we're not in the center of the action. So when you're writing a big picture series of novels, not every character is going to be in every scene, if you will. So I get it, but if I was going to nitpick, that'd be the thing. So at this point in the equation, we have the vice president, who is now the president. They have the ruling faction, if you will, the ruling council, and they're the leftist progressives that have taken over and kind of ruled with an iron fist. They have nationalized all the police. They call it the NSF, I believe, the National Security Force. And they have captured all electronic means of monitoring. And then they have the Truth Reconciliation Council. And yes, that is exactly what you think that might be. They have control of the internet and all media. Now, for me personally, I don't think we're very far from that right now, especially with what Congress just passed, you know, doing away with the 802, or is it 702? But basically taking away or not adding in requirements of warrants to do the invasive investigations into we the people. They've empowered our agencies, the alphabet soup agencies, far too much. We're going to spend some time going forward talking about how do we overcome this. But for right now, for today, in the context of the book, it is fair to say that what I'm reading isn't even necessarily the worst case scenario. It's just a couple of steps removed from where we are at right here, right now, which is what's most impressive and most depressing all at the same time about the book series. And by depressing, I mean just understanding the reality that we're living in is being presented in fiction, only it's really not fictional any longer. It's more reading like a nonfiction description of what we're living through. Now the first book paints the picture of where the world, or where the United States, or Numerica as it's called, is. And that's shocking, but only shocking in the sense that how easy they were able to pull it off. And everything that they've done, you would like to believe it's a parallel universe, but it's entirely plausible in the world that we live in right here, right now. So when I referenced Blue Dawn a couple of weeks ago, and I talked about, you know, going to step into book two here pretty quick. So I finished it. I read it basically over the weekend. And again, I like these books. And I like these style of books. If you've got dystopian fiction, that is not overly graphic, boy, I'm all over it. I must have read probably 50 or more small novels or books that would be considered dystopian fiction. I enjoy them. Because it makes me hyper aware of the potential future based upon the reality of right here, right now. And it actually gives me a little peace in understanding that, well, we're not there yet. We're not this bad yet. And I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, but that's the truth. I need something to dial me back to, hey, we're not there yet. It's not quite that bad. This is so much worse, but we're not there. Unfortunately, especially with some of the stuff in the second book here, everything is entirely plausible, but for a change of government. And we would be there. So that should go to the credit of the author. And again, if you're interested, go to your Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. Look up Blue Dawn book or Blue Dawn series. And if you even kind of sort of like military stuff, or, you know, spy novel kind of stuff, there's enough of that flavor in this that you should give it a try. It's well worth your time. All right. So what I want to do is, in the past I've gone through and read excerpts of books, and when you're doing nonfiction, i.e. addressing specific issues, it's real easy to use that as a predicate to have a longer discussion. But I really, I don't have a lot to add. I mean, it's a good, solid story. I think you would be well vested to read the story, but I did run across something that in the context of the book makes sense, and putting the words in the character's mouth fits with the situation. But being who I am, this is something that I can't just let go and ignore and pretend it's not there. I mean, if it was coming from the Numerica leaders, where they have kind of warped their understanding, actually no worse than what our current warped leadership has done, but I would be all right with it. But here we go. Let me just read you the quote, and I'm gonna back up. It's basically the character is the chief of staff, and he's speaking to the former vice president, now acting president, if you will. And they're having a conversation, and they were just talking about being able to put up different posts on social media and getting things, you know, done. And they're just talking about the different posts that they put up or taken down right away. And they're recognizing that big tech, which had kind of sold themselves out to the NSF, right? That would be the National Security Force. They had successfully wreaked havoc on the NSF. So now they're able to get their message out with less restriction. The big tech corporations are still working against them, but they don't have to also contend with the power of the NSF. So now, in that context, this is where the statement comes from. The president leaned back in his chair and said nothing for a full half minute of deep thought. There isn't a person who has held my office that doesn't think at one time or another about Abraham Lincoln. The South went to war with the North, not because of something he did, but out of fear that he might abolish slavery. We never did anything to the progressives to hinder their rights, but they followed suit with history and took us down out of fear of what my predecessor might do. And then Jack, the chief of staff, said, "Nations built on fear always fail." And then the response is, you know, it can take decades for that to happen. And like Lincoln, I have no intention of sitting back and waiting. This house will not be divided, not on my watch. Okay, it goes a little further and talking about compromise. So as you know, we've talked about compromise a lot in my program. So he says, it is compromised so that the progressives would love it. We would give up a piece of the country for some return to normalcy in the rest. That is where we have failed as conservatives. We constantly compromise with our opposition. We give up something and they hold firm. Bit by bit, it erodes our position until you end up where we are now, under siege and living in fear. I am the president of the United States, not just to the loyal states. We will be whole again, no matter how long it takes, but we are not giving ground. Okay, now in the context of the story, absolutely makes sense, the second quote especially. And actually, the second quote especially, I do agree with almost entirely, wholeheartedly. Well said. Ben, I've said it multiple times myself. It is not an uncommon conversation amongst conservatives, especially conservative activists. But I want to go back to the first quote, and you knew I was. You bring up Lincoln. Oh my gosh. So Brian McClanahan has spent a lot of time on this. Chris Ann Hall has spent a lot of time on this. Tom Woods has spent a lot of times on this, or a lot of time on this. Abraham Lincoln is not a conservative. Abraham Lincoln is basically a progressive. The only quasi-conservative thing he ever did was to hold the Union together. But the method of which he did it was horrific. And I would submit to you that the cost of doing that far outweighed the benefit, in my humble opinion. Now, let's go back to this quote. The South went to war with the North, not because of something he did, but out of fear that he might abolish slavery. Well, first of all, let's set aside the slavery thing for just a bit. We'll revisit that. And look, I know it's like abortion. No matter where you stand on it, you're never going to be happy with what your opponent thinks. So we're not going to go there. And through the lens of time, you know, people just don't seem to grasp that something that was completely normal and accepted 250 years ago can be anathema now. And we don't have to condemn somebody for 250 years ago for something that was completely normal in our modern context. We can just say, yeah, that was normal then. We know that's wrong now, and that's an end, but it's not. It's never enough. So when you say the South went to war with the North, that is about the most short-sighted, abbreviated, inaccurate way of describing what happened that I've ever seen. I shouldn't say that. That's rude. Let's just say that is essentially what we're told in the public school system. And somebody that's a conservative, somebody that, you know, values liberty, somebody that is obviously a good author and probably has some pretty good historical chops ought to know better than this. Now, maybe the argument would be is this is the character speaking and it's not a Mary Sue. It's the character speaking and that's exactly what he thinks. Okay, I'll buy that. And I don't want to impugn anything negative upon the author because, like I said, I've really enjoyed the first two books. I'm in the third book. If I'm going to nitpick, which is admittedly what I'm doing right here, right now, the president character who is supposed to be the conservative, we're going to call him the hero in this play, to have such a poor understanding of what went on with the war between the states is extremely disappointing. Now, again, it might be just his worldview. It might be his interpretation of events. Okay, but it's so historically inaccurate and so detrimental to any cause of liberty, any cause of conservatism, to paint Lincoln as the hero in this case. So, if you'll allow me, seven states seceded. They did not want to partake under the Lincoln administration, but they seceded before Lincoln was actually even inaugurated into office. There was not a war. The outgoing president didn't think it was a crisis. Now, yes, it was problems. Yes, there was, you know, how are we going to deal with this? But they peacefully seceded and went their own way. There was only seven states at the time. And for Lincoln's part, Lincoln was all over the map, and he was a known liar. The reason why they call him Honest Abe is because it was a joke. He was a railroad attorney. He was an expert liar, a very good speaker, a smart guy, yes, but come on, let's get real. The guy said what he needed to say to get what he wanted, and he has been quoted as saying, you know, if I could preserve the Union, then they could all stay enslaved forever. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the story. He was willing to perpetuate it in the southern states as is. The issue, the concern was, what do we do with the new states or the new territories coming in? And there was a disagreement how that might work. In fact, Lincoln was the one that told the southern states that if you'll just stay and or rejoin the Union, you guys can keep your stuff. So that wasn't what he was concerned about. Now, it was good flowery speeches. It was good positioning, particularly after the war started, and things, quite frankly, didn't go so well for the North early on. So you had this cause that you could hold up to bring more people in and to get more people interested. But again, it was manipulation. It was propaganda. Lincoln doesn't care. The only people that really actually cared were the radical abolitionists. Everything else was political ploy. And in today's day and age, we should be able to easily see that and go back and look at what was going on and understand that's exactly what happened. So Lincoln decided to resupply two bases in the South that the South was trying to negotiate purchase or settlement, and they purposely tank those discussions and then provoked the response. You know, Fort Sumter wasn't just fired on for no apparent reason. It was a provocation that they responded to. Now, unwisely perhaps, but when you tell somebody, if you do this, we're going to do this, and please don't do that because we're going to do this, and now that you've done it, we're going to do this, you kind of needed to do what you said you were going to do. In this case, shell a base. And then for that justification, we led to a massive war that was about realigning the federal union in the vision of the radical Republicans. So let me ask you, if you look at it, if you believe the union was worth preserving, if you believe the union was the be-all end-all, might there have been another way to accomplish this? Might there have been other things that could have been done? Might there have been a way to negotiate a settlement? Now, keep in mind, the Northeast had rattled the cage multiple times before 1860 that they were going to leave if they didn't get their way, and the other states negotiated with them to keep them on board. Yet, it's just this one time that we couldn't negotiate a settlement, and it was because of bellicose behavior on the part of old Honest Abe. Now, he's not alone in this. Certainly, there were other people that were in league with him, and I think they ultimately got what they wanted, which was to subjugate a bunch of people. Now, Lincoln did pay the ultimate price for it. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I mean, I don't know that I would ever advocate the ultimate solution on something like that, but I can certainly see where they would feel that it was appropriate. I mean, I find it hard to weep over the death of a political leader that was at least indirectly responsible for over 500,000 other people being dead. I mean, think about it. If you're the Russians and you thought, hey, if we just kill Hitler, this war is going to be over, why in the world wouldn't you do it? Or, to put it in a modern parlance, if you're the Russians and you see this Zelensky dude is causing you nothing but a thorn in the side, but you think that the war would be over if you take him out, or you punish him for bringing about the war by killing him, wouldn't that make a whole lot more sense? I mean, how many hundreds of thousands of people are dead or maimed because of this thing going on right here, right now? And again, I don't even have to take sides. And honestly, it is kind of like a civil war. They're fighting for control of the eastern portion of the country, which is essentially Russian anyway. They can both be bad guys. You don't have to favor either. Just realize that there's a whole lot of dead people, both Ukrainian and Russian. What is to be gained? And yet, we, the United States, where we have all of our own problems, we have all of our own issues where we can't even bother to protect our own border, we're highly vested in somebody else's border. So when I look at how this is playing out, I watch and see what's happening, I can't help but think to myself, the likely outcome is we, the United States, are going to bankrupt ourselves faster. We're going to militarily exhaust ourselves faster, even though we're technically not sending any of our people over there, just our equipment and our extra weapons, right? At what point are we going to realize that we're being set up for failure? At what point are we going to see that that our nation's all but lost at this point? That what was once these United States are far from united at this point? Now, this is a much larger, longer conversation. I don't think there's a good, clean answer for it. I mean, look, I'm a member of T&M. I support Texit. I'm not going to ever back off of that. I've also said, for the record, many, many times, I'm perfectly content with de facto independence if we never get de jure independence, which is to say, we do our own thing but stay part of the union. I'm fine with that. I think that would be oodles better than where we're at right now. But we can't even get any action out of our state leadership, so I'm not going to hold my breath on getting de facto independence anytime soon. The other thing is, at least in this situation, in the book, right, the Blue Dawn series, it talks about they devastated the culture, and now they've had 5 years to basically reprogram people, to reset what reality is to a lot of these people. And it implies that it went down without much of a fight, that every school programs children in it, or young adults, to just accept things and never question anything, and actually purges some of the people that do. And every government agency routinely rounds up and deals with anybody that's a dissident. This is a typical tyrannical government. But it didn't start out that way. We believe we're not there right here, right now, but I'm here to tell you, there, but for the grace of God, we're going to go. We're two steps away. I don't know that the correct solution is for California to go their own way, but it sure sounds better than that outcome. A dystopian, horrific future does not sound like something I would like to experience firsthand. But if it means that the union has to be sacrificed to prevent a civil war, to prevent a dystopian future for the most of us, by all means, California, Oregon, and Washington, feel free to go your own way. We don't need that kind of trouble. If New England wants to go their own way again, by all means, it's not worth it. We don't need you. Just, I got to say, how much better would the remaining states be if we didn't have the crazy leftist progressives on the left coast and in the Northeast? Imagine how much better things would run, how much smoother they would be. Oh, we'd have other issues to be sure. We'd still have to deal with people in Atlanta and in Raleigh, and while we're at it, Dallas and Houston. But at least we would have a much greater numerical majority over the crazy leftists. And if they're so happy with the leftist progressive policies, there's an entire sister country that they can feel free to go to. We'll even transport them there for free. The whole peaceful national divorce, in my mind, prevents a civil war. In my mind, prevents the dystopian future that is, quite frankly, very likely. Now, I don't think anybody in their mental faculties being intact would want to go live in the future California, Washington, Oregon. I don't see how that would turn out for you very well unless you're in that top 1%. Or it is entirely potentially possible. Well, there's a mouthful. It's entirely possible that the whole movement collapses upon itself within a couple of years, that the actual legitimate communists take over. And if I have to sacrifice California to save the other, 40 plus states, is that a fair trade? I don't know. It's plausible. I give up the three left coast states and what? Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, I'm sorry, folks. I'm doing this off the top of my head. Dangerous. We'll give them New York, New Jersey, Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Maine. So seven other states. So if we can give up 10 states and keep the other 40 intact, I mean, that sounds like a pretty good trade-off. Now, New Hampshire going to get screwed in the middle there, but I mean, they could be an exclave, right? Kind of like that little piece of Russia that's beyond the Baltic states. It's still Russia, but it's not really Russia. I mean, we could do the same thing with New Hampshire. Or they might just decide to go independent, be their own republic. More power to them. The free staters up there would probably be even happier with that. Again, you have people that immediately assume the worst. And to be fair, this is one man's novel or series of novels. And I did nitpick one thing and it took me off on a tangent. But that doesn't take away from, one, it's a very plausible outcome. Two, it's a good series of novels. And three, I'd like to see a series of books written off of a different answer. I'd like to think that we could find a peaceful way to solve the problem, to come up with a solution where we're not killing 500,000 people. Maybe that would be a novel we could find somebody to write. But until then, I highly encourage you go read the Blue Dawn series. And with that, this has been According to Callus, and I will see you on the other side.